and I really don't want to get into it. It's kind of an interesting story because the more cows that he paid for his wife, the more valuable she became, the more beauty that she exhibited because she felt like she was worth more. So they would go through this process, and then once the deal was settled, they would sign a contract. And from that time on, and the bride had to agree to this too, and you'll see in this, will you take this man, sort of thing, and she would have to agree or not. And it was her opportunity to deny that. But once they agreed to it, they would basically sign a contract, a ketubah they'd call it, and then they'd drink a glass of wine to seal the contract, and then the groom would go away back to his father's house, and he would establish a temporary house on top of his father's house, like in a room and added to his father's house. And they would call that, in the later times, they'd call that a huppah. And that's where you get this idea of a covering. So he would go back to prepare that house or that addition to his father's house for, and we'd call it the bridal chamber. That's where they would enter into and consummate the marriage. The bride then would take that time, and typically it was about a year, 12 months. And they would typically take that time so that she would prepare. She would go through a period of purification. Now, they also used it for a period of time to prove that the bride was not was still a virgin. So that 12 months, if she was pregnant, she naturally would have shown that in that period of time. So it was a period of purification for the bride. It was a period of time preparation for the groom where he would go and he would prepare this bridal chamber. Now, he would have to supply it and make sure that it was all fitted for everything they needed for at least for that period of time where they would consummate the marriage. And in Genesis, where Jacob goes into, he's assuming he's marrying Rachel, but he has been tricked and he marries Leah. It says that he had to fulfill her week. They would go into this bridal chamber for a 7-day period. So it had to be supplied for everything they needed. Now, the father of the groom is the only one that would determine when that was ready enough. He was the one that sent his son to go and collect his bride. And that's why Christ said, "No man knows the day or the hour except my Father." He was the one that determined when everything was properly set so that he could go then tell his son, "Okay, it's time to go get your bride," and then bring her back into the wedding bridal chamber. And this was usually done at night. The groom would gather up his men, and they would go on a procession to the bride's home. The bride would have her bridal maids there, and they would all have to be preparing for this. And it says they didn't know the day or the hour, they didn't know the time period. They knew, had an idea, but this was usually around midnight when this happened. And they would go and they'd have torches going through the village to try and get to the bride's home. And as they got closer to the home, the best man, the groom's friend, as it's written, would blow a shofar. And they'd make all kinds of noise as a great shout announcing the arrival of the groom to take his bride. Then after that happened, he'd come and take the bride. She would leave her home once and for all, never going back there again. And they would have this procession going back through the city, making all kinds of noise. They would usually raise up the groom and the bride on these chairs. They called them sedan chairs. And they'd carry them through almost like a king and a queen kind of thing. Now, once they got to the bridal chamber, back to the groom's father's home, that's where they would consummate the marriage. But it was a private ceremony. They were already married legally, bound. And that's why when Joseph was found married to be pregnant, he had the opportunity to write a bill of divorcement for her. because legally she was already married to Joseph at the time. So once they got back to the home, they would consummate the marriage. And the best man, the friend of the groom, would stand at the door and wait for this shout from the groom to let him know that the marriage had been consummated, and then the wedding feast could take place outside. The father was the one that provided all the accoutrements for the party. The party lasted 7 days, but the bride and the groom were in the huppah, the bridal chamber, for that period of time. So as all this was taking place, outside the feast is going on, everyone's happy that the bride and the groom have now consummated their marriage, and they're drinking wine, and the men are usually praising the groom for him being married now, and it's a great big deal for these people to do that, to assume this marriage. And at the end of that 7 days, the bridegroom would come out from the huppah and then present his bride. And the ceremony was because this is the first time really that the guest would get to see the beauty of the bride presented. So this is the whole idea of what was taking place in the marriage ceremony back then. I mean, today we couldn't do that. I mean, we couldn't have a procession down, you know, Route 11 with all these people going to kick the bride and then come back and all this stuff. And it just wouldn't work out.
Our receptions today are a far cry from that festivity.
Yeah, they are. They only last for a few hours. And then you have all this nonsense where some guy that doesn't even know the family has to recite the names of the people as they come out. Oh, here's the bride, father. Come on, here. But that's not what they did, because usually it was everybody in the village was invited to this. Everybody from the surrounding towns were invited to this. It was a huge party. So, some of the things that I think that you can go over this, but I wanted to show you some of this in Genesis chapter 24. In Genesis chapter 24, and we can skip over some of the verses, but I just wanted to show you some of this and how it was really laid out in Scripture way back in Genesis. And verse 1, 2, Abraham was old, and God had blessed him in all things. Verse 2, he said to his eldest servant of the house, he made him swear a covenant to him that he would go and select. In verse 3, you shall not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell. I want you to go back to my own country and to my kindred and take a wife unto my son Isaac. So there was actually the bride's, or the groom's father, Isaac's father, Abraham, was here. He was in the process of telling his servant to go and select the bride. So there's where you have, under the marriage thing, the bride is selected, usually by the parents. Then, we can go through some of this, but a lot of it in verse 10 of chapter 24. The servant took 10 camels and camels of his master's, and he departed. All the goods of the master were in his hands. So he had all of this this dowry money, this bride price that he had available. And I'm sure Abraham told him, I want you to make sure that you select the best bride that you can. So everything I have is in your hands. You go and buy whatever you have to. And I think we know the story. This servant was on the way and he was praying. And he said, you know, I want to make sure, so I'm going to go through this ritual. When I go and I get to a well and I ask the young lady, for the first lady that comes, that if she asks me, you know, if she'll draw water for me, and I'll say, sure. And then she said, well, I'll water your camels also. So this is what Abraham's servant has kind of figured out he was going to do. And all of this played out just the way he said. So it was to him a revelation from God that this was God saying to him, this is the woman that I had selected. And he was very pleased with that. So as it goes on, verse 22, So when they had done their drinking, he took out a gold earring and two bracelets of gold and put them on her. So then he asked about the family. He said, can they go over and stay in and visit the family, so to speak? And once he got there, he reiterates the story to Nahor and Laban and Bethuel. So anyhow, as this goes on, in verse 51, the negotiations took place. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be your master's son's wife, as the Lord has spoken. And then verse 53, and the servant brought forth jewels of silver, gold, raiment, gave them to Rebekah. He gave also to her brother and to her mother precious things. So this is kind of the idea of the groom paying not only the dowry to the parents of the bride, but also giving gifts to the bride as well. So the terms are agreed upon. And then in verse 54, you'll see right away, after the terms were agreed upon, they had to eat and drink. And I'm sure they had wine to seal this covenant, so to speak. The terms were agreed upon. Now, verse 55, and her brother and her mother said, let the damsel abide with us, and it should stay here. It says in the King James a few days, at least 10, after that she shall go. But it meant a full year, or at least 10 months. Now, if you wanted to write down in your notes, you could write down Esther chapter 2, verse 12. And that talks about the purification time being 12 months. I don't want to go and go over there. I really want to get to some other things here that are pretty important. So, the groom pays the bride price, which in your notes here, it's a type of Passover with the wine. The cup of wine is symbolic of blood. So it's a type of a covenant that's being made and cut in blood. Even though there's no sacrifice here, it is a sacrifice for the family to give up their daughter. Then, on the notes, the groom prepares the bridal chamber. But in here, we don't see that, except for the fact when you get down into where the servant is bringing Rebekah back. And in verse 58, they called Rebekah and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. And then they pronounce a blessing upon Rebekah. Blessed be you, a mother of thousands of millions, and let your seed possess the gate of those which hate them. Now, there's the big procession coming back, all the camels, all the things that this servant had. Rebekah's going back. And in 67, verse 67, get to a point where she sees Isaac, she gets off her camel, they run together, and Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. Now, his mother's tent is vacated because his mother died, and I'm sure it was a tent right next to his father. So this is the idea of bringing her into this bridal chamber. And they consummated the marriage. She became his wife, and he loved her. So, that's part of it. Where else you have some of this is over in Genesis chapter 29. And I mentioned this already about Jacob and wanting to marry Rachel, but he is tricked by Laban. And then he goes to negotiate more because he already negotiated. The bride price was he was going to serve Laban for 7 years for the price of Leah or Rachel. So he did that. Verse 27, he comes out and says, hey, wait a minute, you tricked me. One of the Laban says, well, I'll tell you what. You fulfill the week. In other words, you already married to Leah. Fulfill her week, and then you can have Rachel also. But you're going to have to serve me another 7 years. So he had to pay another bride price for his second bride. So anyhow, under unleavened bread, I talked about the fact that the bride prepares. This is where we were mentioning Esther chapter 2, verse 12. There was this purification process they would go through. They would have ceremonial washings and anointings, and the bride would also prepare her garments for the wedding. And as it comes down here, it says, and under Pentecost, the groom would send the bride gifts. Now, what he would do is he would send gifts to the bride, let her know that she was cherished, all during this time that he was preparing the bridal chamber, because they were separated for this time period. And if the bride did go out of the house at all, she would have to have a veil on to prove that she was already spoken for. So he would send gifts to the bride to just make sure that she was cherished. The father then determines the time of the wedding. And if you wanted to write down Matthew 24, 36, that's where Christ had said, "No man knows the day or the hour, but the Father in heaven knows that." So he was the one that had known when the time was right to send his son for his bride. And you know, I wanted to touch on a little bit of this because as we go on, I want to show you and prove that this whole thing really is the idea of the coronation of a king. This whole process here, this marriage, and who he's married to is married to a government. The king is being coronated to take a government. So he's not sent back to get the government and bring these individuals back to the government until the time the father determines it's right and the things in the government are ready to be filled. All these positions that he talked about are ready to be filled. And this is where we talked earlier about trumpets in Revelation 11. The groom's arrival is preceded by a shout, like we said, with their proceeding from the father's house to the bride's house, all the entourage, and there's a big trumpet blast, and the men are all going through the city. There's a lot of noise to go and get the bride. Now, let's turn over to John. John chapter 13. In verse 33 he said, "A little while I am with you, you shall seek me. And as I said unto you, unto the Jews, where I go, you cannot come. So now I say unto you." And what he's telling them is that he was going to go and prepare this bridal chamber. And in chapter 14, he reiterates this. "I know that you're, let your heart not be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions." What this is really talking about is, in my Father's house, in my Father's government are many positions. "If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go to prepare the place for you, I will come again to receive you unto myself, that where I am, you may be also." And here's this idea where he's through this Passover meal that they had, and the wine, he also states that, "I will not drink of this cup until the time that I drink of it anew with you in the kingdom." So this is the idea of the cup of wine, because they didn't drink the blood. Christ's blood was actually what seals the covenant and the Passover, but the wine was symbolic of that. So he was actually joining in a marriage agreement, in a marriage covenant with the apostles, or the disciples at the time, with this, to establish this government. And that's what was going on there. It wasn't this he was going to marry this woman or anything, but it was a statement of, "I am going to come again as a king." And I want you to be in these positions to fill that with me. Then we come to the part where he takes his bride to the bridal chamber, and then the marriage is consummated, and that's atonement. Now, I mentioned earlier about Leviticus chapter 16, and also the fact that the Azazel is sent away, and we talked about that in Revelation chapter 20. Revelation 19. If you take a look at a lot of the charts that I had, the other chart where you have atonement happening, trumpets, atonement, and then tabernacles, and it's all happening as Christ is returning, and that's why I said in Hosea chapter 6 verse 3, it talks about the Lord coming as the former and latter rains. There's two advents of the Lord Jesus Christ. One was when they had Passover, and that was the spring holy days, Passover, unleavened bread, and Pentecost. And the second advent is going to be with trumpets, atonement, tabernacles, and then on in through the eighth day, the last day. This is all a process, and you can see even in the layout of the holy days, there was a long gap of time between Pentecost and when tabernacles and trumpets would happen. The same thing here. He goes away to prepare that place. That's the duration of time that's given before he's actually coming back for his kingdom. So he takes the groom takes the bride into the bridal chamber, and the bridal chamber, as I said, was symbolic. Later on they did this like a chuppah. They actually have, in the more modern Jewish wedding ceremonies, they have, it's just a canopy that's over where the bride and the groom go into, and then they kind of exchange vows. It's more like a modern day wedding. But both of them, even in this ceremony that they hold today, you know, we have this idea that the bride is always dressed in white and this virgin idea. Well, the white linen garments that they would wear back then, the groom and the bride would both have white linen garments on when they went into the chuppah. And also, the one thing that they did was they would fast, because it's very typical of the priest, the high priest, would have his white linen garments on and take off his robes of glory and beauty and go into the Holy of Holies. And that's what we would consider the chuppah. And what took place in there was only what God saw with the high priest. Well, it's the same thing in here. In this marriage ceremony, as the consummation of the marriage takes place, it's only between the bride and the groom. So this marriage ceremony that's taking place from history and what they have done is very symbolic of the high priest going into the Holy of Holies and then having the blood spread out on the mercy seat. It's the same thing. When a virgin and goes in to consummate the marriage, they would take and have a special cloth laid out. And what it talks about, when the friend of the bridegroom is standing at the door waiting for the shout to see if the marriage has been consummated, they would present that bloody cloth to the friend of the bridegroom so that all would know. And he would then make statements about the fact that the marriage has been consummated, and then the celebration could take place. So this whole thing of, and that's why it's a 7-day period when they're in there. What was tabernacles was a 7-day period. So here's the bride and the bridegroom are in this enclosure. They're not seen by all these individuals that are celebrating the wedding. And that's what's going to happen when Christ returns. Everybody makes this assumption that when Christ returns, he's going to set up his government, he's going to rule through the millennial period, and every eye will see him, and all of these things will take place. But when you take a look at through Revelation, what's taking place is the taking of the governments of this world by the coming king. And it's a process by which this happens. That's why it talks about the trumpets in, Revelation 11. And then you get to Revelation 19, which I asked you to turn to. And it talks about, in verse 7, let us rejoice and be glad and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. So they're entering in this period of time where they're all starting to gather for this marriage supper. In verse 9, blessed are they which are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And then there's this idea, you can back into Matthew 22, I believe it is. I have so many notes all over the place on this, it just gets to be confusing after a while. Matthew 22, verse 2, Jesus is speaking to them in a parable, and he says in verse 2, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king which made a marriage for his son. He sent his servants forth to call them that were bid to the wedding, but they would not come. So all through this kingdom period, you have this idea, there's a marriage supper because Christ has taken this kingdom, but he's not visible. He's not ruling on the earth like a lot of people think he is. This is what's hard to get a grip on. Someone who asked the question, well, why are there sacrifices during the millennial period? If Christ is there, what do you need a sacrifice for? Because he's not there. And the sacrifice is still an idea to give these people that, you know, you have done something wrong. Your lifestyle is not right. So Israel is going to have to be the vehicle by which the rest of the nations are then converted or brought back into a relationship with God. Once again, they're going to be a servant. And they're going to have the law reestablished. Just like it was on the chart, before grace came, there was law. And even some of the other charts that I've seen, grace is an interruption of law. If grace is an interruption of law, then law is going to be reinstituted again. So, these are the things that are taking place with all of this. And he's trying to show people the bride and groom are hidden. The marriage supper is taking place. Some are called, they won't come. Others, call the lame, call them up, get them here. Doesn't matter. So this call continues to go out through this millennial period to get people into this relationship with God. Because the father said, I'm having a marriage supper for my son. Let's get all these people here that we can. But everybody thinks that, you know, this is going to be where Christ is going to rule. And well, if that was true, then in Revelation 20, when Satan is released from his pit, and he goes and he brings all these people against the saints, how would that be possible if Christ was ruling through this whole 1,000-year period? Do you think Satan would be able to convert people or get them all together to fight against? I don't really think that would work out too well. But it just shows the failure of mankind. So, we got into the part where the friend stands at the door. He is announcing this so that the celebration can take place. And there's other things too with that cloth. The cloth was also a symbol to say that if the groom in the future wanted to divorce his wife for any reason, he could say that she wasn't a virgin before, or he could say a lot of different things. That cloth was proof that she was a virgin when they got married. So there's a lot of symbolism with the cloth. And it's also the period of time where the bride and groom would enter into that. And they would also, that was the second cup of wine that would seal the covenant. And that's why the blood issue is also very important during that period of time. The virgin bleeding, it's almost like cutting the covenant. Once again, it's sealed in blood. And today's time, what they do is they share a second cup of wine. And it's symbolic of, once again, what Christ said with his disciples, I will not drink of this cup until I drink it anew with you in the kingdom or in the government. That's what kingdom really is talking about. So, talk about the guests continue to gather to celebrate the marriage supper. And during this period of time, the groom is praised. Even though they don't see him, they know that he has taken the kingdom. So he is praised, and they sing songs to the groom. So, and it's always been commanded in Revelation chapter 20. It's always been commanded that, like I said, they were commanded to go to the feast, Israel was, keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and to rejoice. It wasn't something that was supposed to be a somber period of time. They were supposed to be joyful. We read this earlier. Chapter 20, atonement is fulfilled where Satan is locked up. And then in the end of verse 4, it says, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. That's the period of time where the marriage supper is taking place. Then you get into chapter 21. This was the eighth day. I saw a new heaven and a new earth. And you go all the way up into verse 9. The end of it says, one of the seven angels which had the seven vials came, said to me, come here and I'll show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. So if this was really a literal a person or a group of people that the Lamb had married, then he wouldn't say that in verse 10, he carried me away in spirit in the great high mountain, showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. So here it is. It's a city. When we talk about what is a... Turn over to Daniel. Daniel chapter 2. So the bride is a city. Not even a person. You could say the bride is a mansion. It had many rooms. And these positions were filled. Daniel chapter 2, it's a story about Nebuchadnezzar having a dream of an image. And he's looking for somebody not only to tell him the interpretation of the dream, but what the dream was in the first place. He wouldn't even tell him. So Daniel prayed to God, and God revealed it to him, and he told him the dream, and it talks about all of these successive kingdoms that were going to take place. This image of gold, silver, brass, and then iron and clay. So at the end of it, in verse 35, and it says, a little later on, I watched until they, when this stone that was cut without hands came down and broke the image, and it was broken up like chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried it away. No place was found for them, and a stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And this is really what we're talking about here. This city, this stone that came down from heaven, and it smashes all of the governments of this earth that have been represented. Because during the millennial period, during that 1,000-year reign, there still are going to be governments on this earth. And these nations are going to be drawn to God through Israel. That's the vehicle that's still going to be used by God to get them to come into a union with Him. Now, obviously, like we talked about with the marriage supper parable, not everyone's going to be accepting of that. But this image then comes down and smashes all of the governments of this world and then grows to be a great mountain and fills the whole earth. In verse 44, it says, and in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom will not be left to other people. He'll break it into pieces, consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand for an eon, forever. Wanted to turn over to Isaiah chapter 2. So, if we're talking about this bride coming out of heaven, this stone that comes down from a mountain cut out of hands or without hands, and smashing the rest of these kingdoms during this eighth day period at the end of the millennium, or the period of time of the new heaven and new earth, as it says in Revelation 21. Here it says in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, "And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations will flow unto it." This is what we're talking. What last days are we talking about here? Are we talking about the last days before Christ returns? Are we talking about the last days of the millennial period? No, we're talking about the last days of the whole creation. That's when, in the eighth day, the last day of the feast. That's the last day that we're talking about here. And I think this is reiterated again. That's the idea of this city coming down, and the idea that God's government is going to take over the whole earth. There's even a parable about the mustard seed, and this tree grows and it fills the whole earth. So this is the whole idea of this marriage ceremony, and how God is trying to show through all these different pictures really what he's trying to do is accomplish the salvation of all, but it's going to be through a government that he's establishing. There's, you know, you take a look at what did the adversary say to Christ during his temptation? He said, "I'll show you all these kingdoms, and they're yours if you'll bow down and worship me." He said, "Because they're mine, and I can give them to whoever I want." So all these kingdoms that are on the earth belong to the adversary now. And it's going to be a process by which they are taken over. When Christ assumes his kingdom, it's going to be a process, because he's not going to do it by forcing people to obey. He's going to do it in a way that's loving. At first, during the millennial reign, it's going to be putting Israel back in that position, what they should have done in the first place, a nation of kings and priests. The priesthood is going to be established. There's going to be a temple. There's going to be sacrifices that are necessary at that time. And why are the sacrifices necessary in the first place? And there was an article I was reading. Why will there be animal sacrifices during the millennial kingdom? And a little later on in this article, it says the primary objection made to the idea of animal sacrifices during the millennial kingdom is that Christ has come and offered a perfect sacrifice for this, and therefore there's no more need for animal sacrifices for sin. However, it must be remembered that animal sacrifice never removes sin, and that the spirituality separated a person from the Lord. What he's trying to say in this article is that it is an object lesson. Is for a memorial nature, but it's an object lesson for them to learn. They'll be shown again that there's sin that has separated man, and that they are, well, like we use in our chart, during the millennial period of time, during the dispensation of law written in their hearts, the sin offering is the one that's going to be very important during that time. But it was for ignorance. And as you move into time period of the last great day, or the new heaven and new earth, when the great white throne judgment is in there and the lake of fire is there, what is that for? It's for these people that have been in rebellion against God. That's the trespass offering. That's why they have to go into that period of time where they're purified once again. So it's all this process that it's just showing how God is really trying to bring all mankind back into a relationship with himself, but he's doing it in a way that is not forcing people to do it. He's offering them this government, this opportunity to live in a certain way. And even during that, even during the millennial period of time and the last great day, the eighth day, the new heaven and new earth, it says, for outside the city are these certain types of individuals, dogs, whoremongers, adulterers, things like that, murderers, liars. So these are the individuals that are going to have to be brought back in to see what is available for them and how they can have that, and they're going to have to be taught. So hopefully that might clear up some of this. I know sometimes to me it's very clear, but I did want to read one thing out of Phil Scranton's book on Journey to and Through the Second Death. He comes to a section way at the end of it, page 173. It said, when Christ returns in glory and power, he will bring all the political systems of this world to their knees. They will be subjected to the rule of the reborn priestly nation of Israel, and there will be a worldwide reign of strict justice and righteousness. The millennial period of strict rule is a display that humanity cannot live in peace apart from receiving the Holy Spirit of God. Even righteous government is insufficient to cure the ills of the world. So that's the idea. You know, the righteous government, even of Israel, reborn in that millennial period, will not be sufficient to cure the ills. Satan will be loosed at the end of the millennium and immediately bring humanity to war with Christ and the saints at Jerusalem. These forces will be summarily vanquished, and then will come the era of the great white throne judgment and new heaven and new earth. So, I don't know. Does anybody have any questions on that? Comments?
I have one, just one.
Okay.
Very good presentation, John, but I'm fascinated by the typology of the marriage too, all that you went into at the beginning. Very interesting to me. But John 14, 1 and 2.
Okay.
Have any of you heard people say this is our place in heaven? You know, they use this for us. And, you know, I've heard it. I still hear it a number of times when I'm talking to people. Where he says, in my Father's house are many mansions or many abodes. Yet if I would have told you, for I am going to make a place for you. And if I should be going and making ready a place for you, I am coming again, will be taking you along to myself. So this has nothing to do with us as the body of Christ. This is, he's talking to his disciples, first of all. And you would explain this then that it's referring to the temple. I heard you say this is referring to the city.
The city.
As a place, a position,
city,
or his disciples.
Yeah, mansion,
within
the city.
Mansion.
It's all the same thing. It's the idea of this is the abode of God. This is where I'm taking you to my Father's house, to the chamber, the marriage chamber. We're going to be united in a government. And my thought is, and I know there's other places they talk about this, how David's going to rule on the throne during the millennial period. Reborn Israel, some of these individuals that have been resurrected, they're going to be ruling in these positions as a co-regent, so to speak, while Christ is in the chamber.
But it's going to be here on earth.
It will
this
be here on earth.
This has nothing to do with a place that we have, like Philippians 3:20. We have a realm inherent in the heavens. It has nothing to do with that. It's referring to a place here on earth. Correct? This right here. Romans 14, 1 and 2.
That's
John.
John
14.
John 14, 1 and 2.
That's correct? Referring to, I believe, reborn Israel.
Here on earth, though.
Yes.
Here on earth.
Now,
or suspended above the earth.
Bill was talking earlier about this idea that, and I wrote this down, he's talking about the one new man, the law, there's judgment through law, and that's the Israel. That's how they're going to rule and reign. And then grace, we work in conjunction with them. The body is supposed to be teaching. We have a teaching role. They have the idea, and it's like I was saying earlier, under law, they have obedience without the understanding. We have the understanding without the obedience. We're supposed to be able to teach why they had to obey, why these things were necessary. So we're supposed to work in conjunction with them to bring not only the celestials, but the terrestrials into conjunction back with God. Now, I'm not saying I have all the answers as far as how this works out, because like I said, the scripture refers to the place that he's going to bring them back to the Father's home, or he's going to take reborn Israel back into the heavenlies for that millennial time. Now, who's going to be ruling on the earth then?
You say he's taking the bride?
He's taking the bride.
To the heavenlies?
That's the way the analogy would play out. But somebody has to be ruling on the earth. And I've always believed that it would be reborn Israel. These individuals like David and even Christ talks about to his disciples that he has given them positions of government to rule over the 12 tribes.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I take that as all being on the earth.
That's on the earth.
Yeah.
That's so that they can actually, like we talked about, in the process of the dispensations, the new covenant is the law written in their hearts, so then they'll be able to keep it with a different mindset. And even when Christ came in flesh and he presented the rules of the kingdom the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, 7, he actually made them stricter. He intensified the rules, so to speak. So it's not that you commit adultery, you can't even lust. You've already committed murder if you're thinking you hate your brother, that type of thing. So the law that has to be written in our hearts to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And that's why some of it gets kind of confusing. A lot of it's written in typology and mystery. There's things that are hidden. So you try to look at it, but when you look at the book of Revelation, in my opinion, is all through it. It's all about how the governments of this world are handed over to the government of Christ. It's about the inauguration of, or the coronation of a king and the taking of his government and how he does that. I started to look at some of the aspects of it with the first three kings of Israel. First three kings of Israel: Saul, David, Solomon. Saul, in my opinion, is a type of adversary. And it was something that he was an attractive individual, and I didn't want to get into a lot of this, but when you take a look at David was anointed to be king, yet he didn't take the kingdom for a long period of time. And there was this constant back and forth with Saul. And then even when David did take the kingdom, he took it in a process. It was Judah first before the rest of Israel. It was 7 years before the rest of Israel would view King David as their king. So, and David was only allowed to deal with the tabernacle. He wasn't allowed to build the temple. It's more of a permanent structure. So Solomon comes along, and his kingdom was one that had, and it's a typology, in my opinion, of David ruling through the millennial period, and then Solomon's reign in the eon of the eons, where all these kings of the earth wanted to come and hear of the wisdom of Solomon. So this is the idea of it.
Yeah.
And the temple was instituted at that time in Solomon. He built the temple and then dedicated it to God. And I know it's a lot.
Well, my main point is, with this question of John 14, it's not referring
It's not referring to us.
The body of Christ in our realm in the heavens. It's referring to Israel here on earth.
That, the only thing I do with that is because, like I said, when I was talking about Colossians 3:1,
body of Christ,
that we're hid with Christ in God.
Right.
Yeah. That we're already seated in heavenly places.
Right.
You know, in Ephesians, talks a lot about that. He's given us positions.
Right.
Apostles, prophets, all these things. There's different positions that we are attaining those positions now.
Good.
It's a government structure still. So, I hope I didn't confuse anyone.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, John. Well, on our schedule, it says that from 5 o'clock on, there is a dinner provided at our home for all of you that want to come and continue our fellowship with one another.